Welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today I will be speaking with Linda Gordon. She's professor of history and humanities at New York University. Gordon and her co-authors, Dorothy Sue Cobble and Astrid Henry, have written Feminism Unfinished, a short, surprising history of American women's movements, published by Live Right Publishing. As a collaborative effort, the book documents the women's movement since the winning of the franchise in 1920. The aim of the book is to recapture feminism as a social movement addressing a diversity of issues and demonstrates its influence in changing American society. The author's definition of feminism or feminisms is capacious, in which it is defined as an outlook. Each of the authors covers one of three feminist eras of the last 100 years, social justice, women's liberation, and the third wave. They take on numerous myths, including the idea that the movement is dead or unnecessary, hampering how the public understands the movement. By focusing on less-known women active on the ground rather than political leaders, they challenge the assumption the movement was largely white, upper-middle-class women. By emphasizing intersectionality, the authors forward women's differing concerns in an ever-expanding agenda. They challenge the idea that feminism is only about women, as they occupy a complex of affected relationships. Finally, they examine the myth that gains in leadership and power by a few elite is a victory for all women. The authors have enlarged the feminist tent and recovered a wide social movement with a vital future. Here is my conversation with Linda Gordon. Now, let me introduce the author, Linda Gordon. Hello, Linda.
Hi.
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. You and your co-authors, Dorothy Sue Cobble and Astrid Henry, have produced a much-needed book. It covers a lot of ground. I was amazed at how much you covered. But first, before we get into the book, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you and your co-authors came to write this book and do this collaborative effort, which I love. I wish we had more collaborative work like this. So how did you come to write Feminism Unfinished?
Well, I've been teaching for years. My field is women's history, but I'm usually writing about other topics that have to do with women. But I think it's mainly as a teacher that I realized how lacking the available material was about the women's movement. I've come to see that I believe it is the most misunderstood movement compared, for example, to the civil rights movement or to the gay and lesbian rights movement. I think more people have more myths about the women's movement than they do about some of these others. And secondly, as a teacher, I'm always interested in books that are brief and that are very clear and that are not written for other academic experts. So I think those two things coming together were the germ that germinated in this book.
So tell me about your co-authors. How did you three get together?
Well, it's an interesting story. Dorothy Sue Cobble I've known for quite some time. She is primarily a historian of women in the labor force and in the labor movement. And I actually happen to have been an editor of an earlier book of hers because it was published in a series that I co-edit. It's a book that she wrote called The Other Women's Movement. But I didn't know Astrid Henry at all. What happened is that I was searching for someone who had a lot of knowledge about the third and so-called fourth wave. In other words, the aspects of the women's movement that have arisen since the 1980s. And I was just reading a lot, and I came across her book, Astrid Henry's book. And I thought, this is absolutely the best thing. This is just terrific. And I emailed her completely out of the blue. It was really a risk because to try to do something that involves as much closeness as writing something together with someone, normally you wouldn't advise doing that with someone you didn't know pretty well. But miraculously, it turned out wonderfully. Astrid is actually not technically a historian. She's a literature scholar, but she is also a women's studies professor. And she's incredibly smart. She was incredibly wonderful to work with. So it was just a stroke of luck. And it was a stroke of my luck that she agreed to work with me on something like this.
Well, it worked out beautifully. I was really surprised how all the essays, the three chapters that you have, just flowed together wonderfully. And it wasn't redundant. It wasn't, you had a coherence to the whole argument. So what is the main argument or objective of the book? You cover a lot of ground, but what holds it together, do you believe?
I think the overarching umbrella is to correct widespread myths, but some of those are really central to the book. One is that the women's movement is not an elite movement and never has been. There's a widespread myth that sort of associates it with highly privileged, white, exclusively white, upper middle class to wealthy women. And that's not the case. Another more, you might call it a geographical myth. One of the things that I have learned is that too much of the story of the women's movements have been told from the point of view of New York City. And that's particularly true of what we call second wave feminism, the feminism that was so strong in the 1970s. The story of New York City might be represented in many ways by someone like Gloria Steinem, who is a really very important person who just helped promote the women's movement so much. But the fact is that those people who became identified as the leaders of the women's movement were often journalists. And that's understandable because as journalists, they had access to the mass media, and they knew how to talk to the mass media, and they knew how to promote the movement and to do this extraordinary thing which Gloria Steinem did, which was to create Ms. Magazine. But the fact is that New York is very unrepresentative, and we wanted to look a lot at what the movement looked like in the rest of this very large country. Not only in big cities, but in some cases in small towns, where it really looked very, very different. The third thing I would say is that there has been a tendency to think of feminism as something that's most associated with issues of sex and reproduction. And those issues were, of course, just enormously important. But the women's movements have often, always been focused on much more bread and butter economic issues, issues of wages, issues of who can get bank loans, issues of how disabled women and otherwise needy women can get access to various kinds of entitlements. So we wanted to a slight extent, to try to make people understand the breadth of the issues that women feminists were concerned with.
Well, one thing that I noticed right off the bat, the way you define feminism as an outlook, and what do you mean by an outlook? And this is a very broad definition, and are there any dangers in that definition?
Well, I think there might be some dangers, but first of all, we wanted to show that feminism is something that has changed historically. For example, in the 1800s, in the 19th century, people we call feminists never dreamed of thinking that men should share in doing housework. It was just not within their realm of possibility, right? They never really dreamed of making big inroads into parts of the labor force, that men had usually dominated. So we have to understand that feminism cannot come up with a single neat definition because it's constantly changed. Secondly, it is also something that varies according to categories of women. For example, women of color in this country have never been able to fight for women's rights in a way that didn't also include a fight against racism. And so struggling against racism was as important a part of their understanding of what a women's movement should be as anything else. And that leads to another point, which is that feminists don't always agree with each other. There have been terrible disagreements, and there have also been, it's not as if feminists have always been wonderful. There were white feminists who wanted to exclude black women from their groups in the American South. That's completely reprehensible, and we condemn it. But on the other hand, you can't not admit that they were also certain kinds of feminists, right? So feminists can be racist. There are feminists who are peaceniks, and there are feminists who are very pro-war. So we're trying to understand something that is rich, changing, and also complicated.
Okay, so, but the question is, so what is this outlook? How would you define it? Is it women who are championing other women, women who are advocating for participation of women?
I think it's more generic and general than that. I think a feminist outlook is one that thinks that women should have more rights and more respect. And you notice I don't say equality, because there was a time when, and there are places in the world today, where there are feminists who would not go so far as to say they ought to be equal to men. I think most American feminists today would. But it has been simply an outlook that starts with the understanding that women are not being treated as well as they should be, and that we need to make changes in that condition. I know that sounds very generic and very vague, but I think it's the only way we can use the term that really encompasses all of the many, many different kinds of women who've been fighting for women's rights.
So it seems that your definition allows for very politically conservative women who would agree, yes, that women need more respect, that women need to have certain rights secured. You don't necessarily have to be politically liberal. Is that correct?
I think that's true. I think it is true, however, that in fact, the great majority of feminists have been politically left or center and continue to be. And I think there's a reason for that. And that is because feminists are challenging usually the status quo. And many, many conservatives don't want to do that. They don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to empower people who are at the bottom. But I think a really good example of this problem is the very popular new book by Sheryl Sandberg called Lean In, which is really directed against a very, very tiny proportion of women who are working in the corporate sector and who face what they call a glass ceiling, who don't find it hard to be to rise up in the ranks of people in the corporate sector as high as they would. And so she coined this phrase, lean in, which is about encouraging women to be more assertive. There's nothing wrong with no one being more assertive. I'm entirely in favor of that. But the fact is that that is a very thin stratum of what I would consider conservative feminism. And it isn't really relevant to most of us. A woman who is a clerk at Walmart is going to get exactly nowhere by trying to be assertive in negotiating a wage raise. And that is even true of me. I'm a professor in a big university. I don't get a wage raise by trying to individually negotiate with one of the deans. It just doesn't work that way. And what I think that the Sheryl Sandberg lean in phenomenon represents is a kind of misconception of feminism as a matter of individual struggle as opposed to group politics. Where feminism has really been successful is where women have gotten together in large groups and really made collective complaints, collective efforts towards really changing things for whole large groups of women.
And I think that this is one of the things that I liked about your book was the fact that you talked about feminism as a social movement. And we're used to reading, you know, feminist history, especially the second wave, that really deal with the political aspects, you know, getting legislation passed and the political players and
right.
political leaders. And by looking at it as a social movement, I think that you're able to encompass many more women. And also what you call feminisms, instead of one feminism, you know, many feminisms. And I did like that about the book. So as a social movement, why did you decide to go that route instead of continuously looking at the political advancements and what else is left to be done politically?
I think partly because there is more literature existing about the realm of politics, but it's more because, and I think this is implicit in what you just said, I mean, for example, Lyndon Johnson wheeled and dealed very effectively to get the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act passed. But nothing would have happened without a massive civil rights movement, which was sending a big message to Americans that African-American people were simply not going to put up with the humiliations of second-class citizenship and economic discrimination anymore. The same thing happened with the women's movement. There were a lot of really important legislators who were really working to establish equal pay laws, laws against violence against women, etc. But none of that would have happened if it hadn't been for literally millions of women across the country organizing and protesting in various ways, whether it was through demonstrations or petitions or letters to the editor or changing curricula in schools. And I do think Americans sometimes fall into the trap of thinking that change comes from the top down. And the fact is that politicians and people at the top have to respond to very large movements from the bottom, so to speak.
So this reminds me of something I think that Henry talks about, is the fact that feminism has been in the air for quite some time now, and that lots of people who would not even identify themselves as feminist, who don't even use the word, have sort of a consciousness, a feminist consciousness, I would call it. And this is something that you, I think, is throughout the book, is how many women were actually operating without that awareness that they're doing a feminist act.
Oh, yes.
And so I'm wondering about what does anti-feminism look like in that kind of in society when everyone, I think even the most conservative, politically conservative, or even cultural conservative people would now say they want their daughters to go to college.
Yes.
It would be a very rare fringe group who would say, I don't want my daughter to get an education or be able to get a divorce if she
yes.
wants one.
Yes.
I think that that is so fascinating that even the most conservative people, I think, would say, I'd reject feminism, but I want my daughter to be able to get a divorce.
Yes, and, you know, this raises a really interesting question, and that is, should one use the term feminism? There's a very common phrase that many people who've thought about this observed, and that is when you talk to people that so many people say more or less, I'm not a feminist, but. And then what comes after the but is things like, well, I certainly believe in equal wages, or I certainly believe that women have to have access to birth control, or whatever it is. In other words, they go on to show that they agree with most of what you'd call a feminist platform. I think that some of the people who are the most vociferous in saying they're not feminists are on the issues the most in agreement with feminist platform. And so some people have sometimes counseled, well, don't use the word feminism, because that's a kind of scare word. It's like what it was in the 1950s, where calling someone a communist would, really raise everyone's hackles. I think we all felt differently about it, the three of us who wrote this book. We felt that there is a reason that we need to take that term feminism and try to remove it from being, from the, you know, the status of being a kind of scare word, the F word. Because if we don't have that word, it becomes very difficult for us to understand our historic connection with all the millions of women that came before us for several centuries, and not to mention the women who will come after us. And it isn't just women, it's also men, because there are tons and tons of male feminists. That it is an honorable word and a very, very honorable cause, and one that we should not try to hide from, even if it means that in the short term we might eliminate some supporters who can't go along with that particular word.
Because,
it is also part of that very, very dangerous myth in America that feminism has been a white thing, because there not only have been very strong black feminism and Latina feminism and so on and so forth, but the association of feminism with white women has done a lot to divide people.
And I think you just brought up a point that one of the problems that we still have after all this women's history that has been done, how little people know about women's history. And I think, it's amazing to me. People think it's been always this way. And they don't realize how short that history actually is in terms of, it's long in terms of how long it took, but how short it's been since women have had the rights that they currently have, in terms of the history of the world or the United States.
I think that's right. And I think this is one of the two reasons that we wanted, ironically, to keep our book very short. That was a premise that we had from the very beginning, that this has to be a short book. One, because we really hoped to get a widespread readership. And we wanted to keep it inexpensive and easily accessible, and a book that you would think that you could get through. And the second reason, what had to do with teaching. We wanted a book that was short enough that teachers could use it as an additional resource in a class. And we're thinking not only college, but also high school, that if someone was teaching a course in, say, American history in general, they might not be able to use a 300-page book in that course because it's too long, but they might be able to use a book of about 150 pages.
Right, and I think part of the beauty of this book is that it covers so much in such a short, and it's also very accessible in terms of the language, so that I think a layperson, the general public, could read this book and get a lot out of it.
I hope so. I've always been, in everything I've written, I've been very hostile to academic jargon and use of big fancy words as a way of, raising the status of what you're writing. I'm really very, very committed to writing everything in very plain English, and that's a lot easier for historians to do than other people. We don't really have a jargon. And for example, I recently wrote another book in which my editor challenged me to write the whole book without using the word gender, and to do so because to many people that sounds like a certain kind of academic jargon. I don't know that I completely achieved that. I think I did have to use the word once or twice, but I thought it was really something good to try. It was an interesting exercise.
Which brings up the whole issue here is, how has the differentiation between sex and gender actually affected how we perceive feminism or women in general, because the gender and sex have become very fluid in theory. And I'm wondering if that has undermined the whole category of woman by which feminism was built. I mean, feminism was originally built in the belief that there was such a thing as woman or women with distinct characteristics and, you know, handicaps in culture. And once you undermine that because of gender theory, I wonder if what the future holds. That's one thing that came up in my thinking about what you wrote.
I think that's a very serious concern. For example, probably most women's studies programs throughout the United States have changed their names to include the term gender. And there's one thing about that I think is very good, which is the challenge to understand that men, too, have a gender, and that masculinity is something that we need to think about, how it is constructed and how it influences our world. For example, I think we need a lot more thinking about the relationship between masculinity and all kinds of violence, whether it's local domestic violence or whether it's the violence of a group like ISIS or large nations. But there has been a downside. I think that for many of these, in these women's studies programs, they, what they teach and what the work is that goes on has been, increasingly focused just on theory, on kind of very abstract notions. What is gender? How does gender work? In very vague ways. And a tendency to leave out or to de-emphasize the really concrete discriminations against women, the concrete problems that women face, so that people like myself, as an historian who deals in the concrete, you know, I'm always interested in the facts, we feel that there's a problem there, that these are not women's studies programs that are necessarily helping young women and men to face the world that they live in.
Do you think that that's...
On the other hand, let me just say one more thing. Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right.
It's very interesting about how the word gender has become so widespread. Sometimes you can see the power of a movement by looking at how it changes language. A really good example is the word sexism. Right now, everyone in America knows the word sexism, what that means. That word didn't exist until the women's movement created it. It's very similar with the word gender in that I think a very high proportion of people today understand that gender is something that is created in people by how they're raised and socialized, that it's not a matter of the body. And so in that sense, it's a great sign of the achievements of the women's movement. But it absolutely does, as you say, tend to take the attention away from the possibility of women as social actors, as people who can actually create change in the society.
And I think I wonder if this is a problem of the West, because I think you talk in your book about global feminism and how far flung it has become. And I think people in Asia, women in Asia or in Africa or Latin America their lives are limited by the definition woman and what a woman is. And to tell these women, of course, that gender is fluid and even sex is fluid, and they're going, oh, really? Because they're living a very concrete experience of womanhood that is very limited. So I'm kind of wondering if Western feminism, with all the gender theory that we've adopted, really can grapple with the real concrete problems of real concrete women all over the world.
I agree with you, and I think one lesson we can draw is that feminism always has to be created in a particular context by the people who live in that particular context. And we absolutely cannot define what can be feminist in Egypt. That has to come from Egyptian women. A really good and somewhat bitter example of that is the campaign against female genital surgery, which is still widespread in some countries, and there were Americans who sought to campaign against it. And it really didn't work because that was so easy for people to target as a foreign imposition. That movement had to come from below, from those women who live there, and it has had great success there. But we also have to understand that women have different priorities. For example, we in the West may think that one of the meanings of feminism is that women are not only mothers and that we shouldn't be associated only with raising children and that men should be involved with raising children too. But for example, in large parts of Africa, the absolute highest priority of the women's movement is getting health care and education for their children. I think we have to understand that this is a feminist priority for those people. It comes out of their role as women. They are people who live in a culture in which they alone are responsible for their children, and wanting the best for their children absolutely comes directly out of their situation as women. And that's just another example of why we have such a capacious definition of what counts as feminism.
One thing that I noticed that was kind of notably absent in the book is the whole idea of choice. And I don't mean just, you know, abortion, but I mean we've made a very big deal out of choice. You know, women should be able to choose who they marry, whether they have abortions or not, whether they have cosmetic surgery or not, whether they wear the Muslim women wear the headscarf. You guys do not talk about choice very much. And I'm wondering how choice spills over into a global setting when we think, how can women make these kinds of choices that seem to us in the West as being anti-woman?
I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, some of it is that, you know, we just couldn't cover everything and it wasn't one of the themes we chose. But I think the fact is that, you know, to use the word choice as a slogan implies that people are free to really make choices, when in fact, for most people in the world, our choices are very, very constrained. You know, if, for example, in the United States, one of the things we know from poll data is that very, very large numbers of women with small children would prefer to be employed part-time. But they can't do that because they can't earn enough from working part-time, because most part-time jobs don't have benefits. So to talk about what they're doing is choose whether they're choosing to be in the labor force or choosing to stay home with their children is a choice that only very, very privileged women have. And I think this is true in just every arena, that when we say choice, we sort of insinuate that there's really a free set of preferences that one can choose among. And most of us don't have that set of choices. I think it's even true, I would argue, and I think a lot of other people would, that choice becoming the slogan of the abortion rights movement was also a mistake, because when women are making a decision about what to do with an unplanned pregnancy, there are so many constraints about what surrounds the decision to either not have an abortion or to have an abortion, that choice kind of mystifies the issue.
It's almost like culture often can act as duress. You end up making certain choices, for instance, to have a child or not to have a child, because there are people around you who are in expectations around you about what you have to do. And so makes you wonder how free women can actually be in making those choices. But then we don't want to deny their agency either.
Right. I think what the way you just put it is really important, because I think the other thing about choice is that it's based on an individualist assumption that we are all individuals making choices kind of in a vacuum, and that we are all subject to group pressures, to the force of tradition, to what is considered acceptable and not acceptable in our social world, and that's, again, it doesn't have to be the meaning of choice, but it does have those connotations of that kind of individual isolation that I think are really wrong.
I want to get back to some of these chapters. The first chapter by Dorothy Sue Cobble on basically the labor feminist, which she's calling the social justice feminist of post-1920. I found that chapter, I've read her book before, and I found that chapter very interesting about how labor women understood what they were fighting for, very different from what came after. So would you please talk a little bit about that, about what they were fighting for? And it wasn't equality like we think, sameness.
No, right, right. Well, first of all, I think we have to start with understanding that most of the history books imply that after the passage of the Woman Suffrage Amendment, after women got the vote in 1920, that there was nothing really happening on the women's rights front between about 1920 and about 1960. And it turns out that that's wrong, but that they thought that because they were looking for a kind of movement that they had seen in the past, which was the woman suffrage movement. And they weren't looking at the labor movement, and that the fact of the matter was that in those years, in those four decades, that is where most of the action was, because as an industrializing country, we were rapidly drawing more and more and more women into the labor force, and they were extremely discriminated against there. But it's also important to understand that the women were being drawn into the labor force not because they were trying to get away from domesticity, but because increasingly their families needed their income. And so in a certain sense, the fight for better treatment and better wages for women in jobs was a fight that was conducted on behalf of families. And in fact, I think we also need to look at something that's a little bit the reverse today. You know, we can claim with pride that between, about 1970, when the women's movement really started to reach its peak, and today, women's wages have increased as a percentage of men's wages, right? In the early days, we used to say it was 59 cents that women earned to every dollar that men earned. And today that gap is up to 80%, so women earn 80 cents for every dollar that men earn. But the fact is that during that period, men's wages have declined in their actual buying power. And so even though women have gained some, the families that they live in have not necessarily become better off. And the fact is that most women are economically involved with men. And this will continue to be the case even if, as we have more equality and freedom for gays and lesbians. You know, women have fathers and brothers and husbands and boyfriends. And so we really need to keep in mind that this is something that should not be a zero-sum game between how much women earn and how much men earn. And that was true in this earlier period, too, that by fighting for better conditions for women, women were fighting for better conditions for their whole families.
What was interesting, too, was that the fact that the labor feminists were, for the most part, for most of their history, opposed to the ERA.
Yes.
And Alice Paul and her equality feminism. talk about for the audience why they were against the Equal Rights Amendment.
They were against the Equal Rights Amendment because they had fought for and won a number of very special protections for women in the labor force, which they considered extremely valuable and which might be struck down by an Equal Rights Amendment. These protections included things like, for example, the amount of weight that a woman worker would be allowed to carry. There were laws that prohibited employers from forcing female workers to work at night because of the dangers of women having to travel to and from work at night. Some states had an 8-hour a day law that affected women only. They were trying to prevent the super exploitation of women. What happened is that as the labor market changed by the 1970s, the whole situation had changed. Women didn't need those kind of protections as much, people were more concerned to have protections for all workers. So, for example, we began to have a stronger OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health set of regulations that protect all workers from certain kinds of harsh conditions at work. But it's true that it was also more complicated by just traditional ideas, because in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, there was a lot of fear in this country that if you put women into very male-type jobs, they would become defeminized, right? And I think that opposition to the ERA also rested on those kind of ideas, even among feminists, that you didn't want to have a kind of sameness between women and men.
Now, in the second chapter that you wrote about women's liberation moment, you talk about the fact that the women's liberation was very much focused on the self, you know, your experience, and not so much a social thing. Is that because of the kinds of women who were going into the movement? They were coming from more economically privileged backgrounds, and they could actually have the luxury of worrying about some of these things.
Yes and no. I think that one of the main backgrounds to what happened in the 1970s was the huge expansion of higher education for both men and women. In the 1930s, that was the first time, even when the majority of Americans graduated from high school. So for a lot of that earlier period, the women in the labor force are women who really had very little education by our standards. After World War II, there was this huge expansion, particularly of the big public state universities. And so by the late 1960s, you had these large, large groups of women who had been in schools like that, who had seen that they were every bit as good students as men, that in every area they were absolutely as capable and competent. But then they were facing all this discrimination and frustration of their hopes and dreams when they got out of school. So in that way, yes, the big movement that burst out in the late 1960s was primarily a movement of women who were college women, either college students or college graduates. But I don't think it was less a social movement, because I think that everything about women's liberation was about women working together in groups, first in consciousness-raising groups where they were really beginning to explore their own experience, but to explore it as a group. You would be in a consciousness-raising group and you would confess that you were constantly worried about being too fat, and then you would find that every other woman was always also worried about being too fat. And then you started to ask questions about that. Well, what is it that makes us feel so inadequate about our bodies? You even got women who were in groups that were absolutely personal and enough to say, well, I don't really feel like I like sex very much, or my sex with my boyfriend isn't very good. And then you would find that a lot of other people would feel that. So I think it was absolutely social, but it was also inward in that women were first beginning to explore their own experience. And out of that came this famous slogan, the personal is political. In other words, what you once thought was personal, which is that you always worried about your own body, turned out to be not a personal thing at all, but a large-scale issue of the way beauty standards were sort of imposed upon women.
And the movement, from what you've written about, you wrote about this, but also we've all experienced this of a certain age, that the movement named a lot of things that had been unnamed. Sexual harassment, domestic abuse, a lot of things that were there, but nobody ever really even thought them as being abnormal or not right. It was sort of accepted that sexual harassment was going to happen on the job.
Right.
And that was just normal. That's what the world was.
And, exactly.
And that's the naming of things, I think, was one of the biggest contributions of the women's liberation movement. Now, you talk about how they were not, these women in the movement were not very aware of women's history, which I found rather odd.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Is that correct? Did I read
yes,
that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So they were kind of creating women's history on the spot.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I experienced personally an example of that even quite a bit later than the women's movement in 1984 when I moved to Madison, Wisconsin and started teaching there. And Madison is a Big Ten school and football is a very, very big deal there. And the 70,000 person stadium would be packed in every football game. And there was a tradition that was called body passing. I don't know if you've heard of this, but in the sections particularly where students sat, guys would pick up a girl, a student, until she was horizontal and she was being held up by the hands of many men, and they would pass her around the stadium from groups of hands to other people's groups of hands, and she would end up far from where she belonged. And meanwhile, she was being handled by, her body was being handled by all these strange men. Now, there were, one of the issues in this practice was that the women were really, I think, forced by public pressure to pretend that they liked this. To pretend that it was a gas and a kind of a joke. There was a movement which got this not only banned, but people began to reappraise what they thought this was, from an innocent prank by the boys to something that I think a lot of women began to consider sexual harassment. This is not pleasurable. This is not something that we need to pretend that we like. I find that a really, really good example of the way that these things change their meanings and get named in a way that really changes our understanding of what's going on. And that was very similar to what happened in lots and lots of office behaviors where, you know, getting pats on the butt and stuff like that, women were supposed to take as acceptable, cute, flirtation, and they began to say, no, this is not pleasurable, this is harassment.
Okay, let's go on to the last chapter, which is Astrid Henry's chapter on what happened after mid-1980s with feminism and how it was revitalized, and there was sort of a period there where it had lost a lot of political energy, even though it still had a lot of cultural power that many people were unaware of. So if you could talk a little bit about that, the third wave, and now sure. What I'm hearing is the fourth wave.
Yes, and I don't know when we're going to stop calling them waves because, you know, there's waves have a certain regularity in the ocean and they don't in social patterns. So, but anyway, I would say there are two really big changes that, well, maybe three really big changes that came up after the 1980s. The first was that a lot of the formal women's liberation groups had been at first overwhelmingly white. And one of the things that happened somewhat later is that all kinds of groups of people of color, African Americans, Latinos, American Indians, Asian Americans began establishing their own groups. And actually, many of these people, black feminists, have really black feminists in particular have really created a sea change in the culture. And in fact, a really good example of this today, one of the things that makes me happy is that when I look at television, for example, particularly MSNBC, you see now so many more women of color who are the news people and the interviewers and so on. And, you know, they are not all by any means primarily feminists, but my suspicion is they are all privately feminists, and none of this would have happened without this kind of movement. So, and, you know, the early third wave people included very, very prominently women of color. So that was a very big change. Another big change, of course, was the Internet, and that came a little later. But the ability for ideas to travel moved from, you know, the speed of the U.S. mail to, you know, the warp speed of what goes on the Internet. And we've all, you know, I now all have this expression, it went viral. And we know what that means and how fast people can communicate, and that both means how quickly people can come to support other things that other people are doing, but also there's a lot of the negative, and there's a huge problem of a lot of hate talk against women on the Internet. The third big difference, I think that the second wave, the big, big women's movement of the late 1960s and late 1970s, tended to be hostile to the sexualization of women. This is the period when women started wearing blue jeans and comfortable shoes and letting their hair be natural if they were black, and even in, for many of them, not wearing makeup, etc. And partly it was a way of saying, rejecting the way that the commercial culture forced women into conceiving of themselves as decorative objects, you might say, or seductive objects. I think that more recently, and I personally am very comfortable with this, women started saying, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be beautiful, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to be sexual. It's a much more both beauty-affirming and sexuality-affirming sense of a feminist identity. And it, with that in mind, it fits very comfortably with the LBTG movement, et cetera. So in that way, I think this movement is very, very different. But on the other hand, I think at bottom, there's a lot that's the same. It's just that people don't really feel the need to articulate it. I mean, I can't find anyone among my college students who doesn't think that women have absolutely every right to demand equal wages, equal access to promotion, equal access to leadership. They just take all that for granted. And, you know, they tend to think it was always that way. But that's fine with me. I want them to just take that for granted and just to be shocked if anyone says otherwise.
There's a whole issue here, too, of what I'm calling late feminism is Henry talks about this slut walk. And this fine line between wanting to affirm women's sexual agency and their rights to pleasure and beauty, and then how we do that without, they're trying to reclaim the whole idea of the slut. But I'm wondering if that really sort of plays into it in a way that's not helpful. It's really difficult to play that, especially when you get on the media. When the media gets a hold of it, you can't control it. You think you can control it while you're protesting on the street, but what happens when it goes through media and it's on Twitter and Facebook and all that? What are your feelings about that or your ideas about that?
I think I'm inclined to agree with you, if I'm hearing you correctly. I know, for example, that when one of the first so-called slut walks happened, a very large collection of black feminists wrote a letter of protest talking about how those kinds of horrible terms have been hurled not only at all women, but have had particular impact on women of color, who have always been so much more vulnerable to sexual violence than white women have, at least historically. I think that's a problem. And furthermore, I often have to admit to my younger students that I'm kind of a prude in relation to them. But I do worry about the over-sexualization of the whole culture, and I believe that it is primarily driven by the capitalist economy and by the constant desire to sell things that are based on that sexualization. So I do have a lot of nervousness about it. But on the other hand, as with so many things, there are positives and there are negatives. I mean, one of the issues that you confront all the time if you teach college students, as I do, is stuff about the so-called hookup culture, and which is basically a culture of very, very casual sexual relations. And I've learned two things about it. First of all, I think it's exaggerated how many young people are really into that. And secondly, that it does have one positive side, which is young women's ability to be very assertive about sexuality, as opposed to in my day where you just sat and waited by the telephone and waited for a young man to call you up. I do feel terribly nervous about it, and there are times when I actually have come close to believing in censorship when I see these advertisements that have even really very young-looking kids have clothes, when I see these beauty contests where little four-year-old girls get dressed up in bikinis and lipstick and, kind of flip their hips back and forth. It gives me very, very great pause.
Yeah, because it's really not just about sexuality in culture. It's about pornography. It's the pornography nature of it. But it's not just sexuality. It's sexuality kind of put together with power. And that's what makes it. If it was just sexuality, I think most of us could to deal with it. So let me ask you. I'm backing up a little bit here, but it was the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas hearing that Henry really puts a lot of emphasis on. And then 9/11 as being two events that rallied a new generation of young women for feminism. And I knew that Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas was a big deal, but I didn't really see it as a watershed event.
Right. Well, I think it was for some people, and I think, of course, particularly for black women. And I remember really liking the idea that when Astrid Henry came up with the idea of starting that way, because, in our new world of televised everything, it was one of these moments when huge, huge numbers of women were absolutely riveted by a public spectacle of a very distinguished, impressive, high-achieving woman being humiliated by this absolute panel of all men. It's visual symbolism, I think, was just so great. It sent people into literal rages. And I do think that that is something that continues and continues to reverberate in different ways, which is, you know, during the 1970s, in the women's movement, one of the songs that became almost like the anthem of the women's movement was Aretha Franklin singing R-E-S-P-E-C-T, respect. And I do think that, you know, in addition to all the material issues about equal pay and about abortion and about domestic violence, there's also something else, which is just simple respect. And the way that men could get away with that disrespect was completely maddening. And that still happens a lot, all the time. And I do think that it has a very great power to make women across a lot of different categories, women across different classes and different races, just say, this is disgusting. So in that sense, I do think it was a very big deal for a short time.
But what about 9/11?
9/11. Well, it's complicated. You know, 9/11 in a way has changed everything in that it's and now the rise of ISIS in that it has really, I think, greatly reduced the personal freedoms that Americans have and has resulted in some governmental behaviors that are, to me, very threatening. By 9/11, I had moved to New York City. I'm not a New Yorker, but that is where I live now. And I experienced it firsthand. I lived down near the towers. But one of the things that struck me in New York City was, you know, there was immediately a lot of public displays of various kinds of things. There were a lot of people put up a lot of wanted posters. Not wanted posters, that's not quite the right word. A little sign with a picture of someone saying, have you seen the whereabouts of so-and-so? And these were almost always, you know, people who they feared were killed in that violence. But there were also, you know, many, for example, around a park near where I live, a huge park, people put up white sheets around the whole fence around the park, and everybody started writing things on those white sheets. And there was a lot of make love, not war, and peace is the only answer. And a lot of people who did not want a militarized response to this. And I do think it's one of those times that reminded me that gender is terribly involved in American foreign policy. But on the other hand, I certainly don't think that there was any kind of feminist majority that believed that we didn't need to defend ourselves and to try to find and, you know, end this terrorist group and its attacks.
I think Henry does talk about the fact that the 9/11 was a very galvanizing event for a world consciousness among young feminists in America, that they began to become aware of, in a significant way, of women all over the world.
Yes, I think that's true. Although that had been growing because there had been these various UN meetings women's movement representatives from all over the world. And I do think that people who have been, you know, have tried to follow what's been going on, and one of the things we do understand is that there was a time when the United States was kind of the vanguard of feminism, but that is not any longer the case, and that they're actually, you know, for example, the in India and in Egypt and in quite a number of places right today, there are major movements against sexual violence against women. Just like here, there's a big movement against sexual violence on campuses. And a lot of these things are in a situation where we could learn as much from people in the rest of the world as they could learn from us.
Okay, Linda, you have been very generous with your time, and I do have to ask you, because you're such a prominent women's historian, I have to ask you, where is the state of the field, women's history?
The state of the field of women's history, sometimes I'm kind of disappointed, because I think that I was lucky enough to be part of it when there was such an excitement of breaking new ground, and I feel very lucky. I feel like it was a lot of fun. I think it has diminished a little bit. I do think that to some extent we have succeeded in making people who have very, very different topics integrate issues of women and gender in them in a different way. But I also do sometimes regret the fact that people are not pushing forward with that as much, because there are still many, many areas of study that are untapped as yet, where people really need to do a lot more work. But on the other hand, I do have a lot of faith in the younger generations of people coming up, precisely because in history classes and everywhere, they take certain things for granted, and they are raising questions that still need to be raised, and I think they will go on to do it. And I have a lot of graduate students who are doing just absolutely wonderful work. If anything, I think the things that I am most eager to see developed are feminist takes on kinds of topics that are not usually thought as women's history. One of the major ones is, for example, foreign policy. Another one is talking about the whole economy. For example, in my department, where people are developing a curriculum in economic history, but it is really easy to leave women out of that, because for so long, historically, women's work was not wage-earning work, and therefore it didn't get counted by economists in their understanding of how societies run. So I think there's just still a huge amount of work left to be done.
Well, thank you so much, Linda. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.